Morning, everybody. So, as I was mentioned, I've been looking at Sharp's injuries for the better part of the last 10 years. This week actually marks the 10-year anniversary of the federal legislation for needle stick safety and prevention, and also marks the 10-year, or in April, I think August, I'm sorry, marks the 10-year anniversary of our state-based legislation to protect healthcare workers from Sharp's injuries. So I'm just going to share with you some information from a small study that we've been working on with Sharp's injuries among both attending physicians and medical trainees. And we actually have the luxury of having some occupational medicine residents from the Harvard School of Public Health do a rotation with us. And several years ago, one of them said, hey, this is something we should be looking at. So we do know that there are differences in Sharp's injury rates, and there is evidence in the literature that medical trainees have a greater risk of occupational exposure to bloodborne pathogens than attending physicians. And this could be due to the nature of work in terms of the tasks and procedures performed, inexperience, but also fatigue, and that was mentioned earlier as a risk factor for injuries. We haven't found any studies that compare characteristics of these injuries between the two groups, although there are studies that do describe injuries among medical trainees. So the Massachusetts regulations, they cover all healthcare workers in Massachusetts hospitals that are licensed by the Department of Public Health. We have about 100. We're not concerned with just employees, but we are concerned with anybody providing care within the facility, regardless of the source of compensation. Our legislation matches the federal bloodborne pathogens standard, where you must use Sharps with engineered Sharps injury protection features. You must maintain a written Sharps log, and Massachusetts has the added requirement that that log be sent to us on an annual basis, and that's the source of all of this data. This is a sample of our log, although it's an outdated log. We've added a couple of more fields. So just the methods. From 2002 to 2009, we've had over 25,000 injuries among healthcare workers in the state of Massachusetts, again, for just 100 hospitals. We excluded injuries that didn't occur to physicians, and then we also excluded injuries among physician assistants, which and if you look at our other data, we actually lump PAs in with physicians because the nature of work seems to be similar. We excluded a handful that lacked any date of injury. And so we ended up with a little bit over 8,000 injuries, a little bit under 5,000 among medical trainees, and a little bit more than 3,000 among attending physicians. And this is the distribution of the occupation groups. You see 46% are interns and residents, with only 7% being fellows and another 6% being medical students. I will say about the attending physicians, while all of them are MDs, this is how our data comes into us. Some people do designate whether they're an anesthesiologist, radiologist, surgeon. So this is just to show you that the pattern of injuries has changed over time. We are seeing an increase in the number of injuries among medical trainees, and that is due in part to the increase in the number of teaching hospitals within the state. I think in the beginning in 2002 we had about 14, and in 2009 we have a little bit more than 20 hospitals which qualify for teaching status. We have, however, in some other studies looked at Sharp's injury rates, and while rates have decreased over time for both groups, the rates for the medical trainees has remained higher than that for attending physicians. Here's just some injury characteristics. Much like our aggregate data set, most of the injuries are occurring within operating and procedure rooms. Most of the injuries are occurring with suturing procedures and injection procedures. And when you look at the device involved, that follows the types of procedures. Within the operating rooms, we are seeing that, as I mentioned, majority of the injuries occurring with suturing, but we're seeing more of the injuries in medical trainees occurring with suturing than the attending physicians, and just the opposite is true when you look at making the incision. And so it's sort of, you know, the question arises, are they either less proficient, the medical trainees, are they less proficient in suturing, or are they doing more suturing? When we looked at injuries among the inpatient units by procedure, we're seeing that a quarter of the injuries are occurring among medical trainees with blood procedures. And the first resident that we had who did this project suggested that perhaps we shouldn't have the least experience doing some of the most high-risk procedures. Injections in our aggregate data set are one of the most common injuries, but the transfer of blood is much lower, obviously, than with these blood procedures. And again, you're seeing the pattern is opposite among the attending physicians. When we did look at injection procedures, however, with the two groups, we are seeing almost 30% of the injuries among medical trainees occurring with recapping the needle. The Federal Bloodborne Pathogen Standard prohibits this practice. When we look at our aggregate data set, only about 4% of all the injuries are occurring with recapping needles. And so while we're seeing more injuries among the medical trainees than the attending physicians in this category, we are wondering whether the medical trainees are modeling the behavior of the attending physicians. We looked at line procedures, and while these are similar in terms of the number of injuries occurring with IV stylets, again, we wonder about the proficiency with this technique. And again, this is another high-risk procedure in terms of transfer of blood and disease transmission. With line procedures, one thing to point out, while these percentages are small, securing a line doesn't necessarily have to be done with a suture needle. And there are several kits out there that have actually straight suture needles rather than curved suture needles. And straight suture needles pose greater hazard. Often they're not used with a needle driver, they're used by hand. So it points out some changes in practice that perhaps need to take place within the facility and the types of devices that are purchased when looking at securing lines. When we looked at blood procedures, we're seeing 33% of the injuries among medical trainees occurring with winged steel needles and only 19% with attending physicians. And again, that begs the question, is there some issue about proficiency with particular devices? Within the hypodermic needle and syringe category, about 80% of the injuries among medical trainees with hypodermic needles and syringes were occurring during arterial blood gas, which is typically a more difficult procedure than a percutaneous venous puncture. And with attending physicians, it's only about half of the injuries among hypodermic needles and syringes. So again, we don't know anything about proficiency, but we think that the hospital should start looking at this. I mentioned that both the state and federal regulations require that hospitals and any other, for the federal regulations, any other healthcare facility must use devices that are sharps with engineered sharps injury protections, and that's the CSIPs. And we're seeing a majority of the injuries occurring with devices that lack those sharps injury protection features. And we've actually excluded suture needles from this group because for suture needles, the only sort of quote-unquote safer product is a blunt suture needle, but their use is extremely limited. So this says to us that we need to do a better job of getting the right products into the hospitals and getting them into the hands of the end users. When we looked at injuries after use of the device, when actually the presence or absence of the sharps injury prevention feature actually matters, we're seeing that with medical trainees, more injuries are occurring while they're activating the sharps injury prevention feature. So that speaks to possibly training, need for more training, or better device design. June Fisher out of TDICT in San Francisco says that if it takes a lot of training, then perhaps there's an issue with design. If it's not intuitive and it's not simple, then we need to look at a better product. Again, we are seeing the high proportion with recapping needles. This, however, we found to be the most interesting of our findings. We took the data, which we collect on a calendar year, and for 2002, we took off the first 6 months. In 2009, we took off the last 6 months so we could look at this on an academic year starting at July 1st. And while you look at the attending physician injuries, is staying relatively stable over the academic year. However, we are seeing a decrease in the injuries among medical trainees. We don't know whether this is a sign that they're getting more proficient as the year goes on, or whether they're deciding that they don't have time or it's not important to report their injuries, and we hope it's not the latter. What we would like to do is collect this data with greater detail and look at postgraduate year 1, 2, 3, 4, and then separate out these years and see where people fall, and is it, you know, the least experienced of that group where we're seeing any changes. By device used in medical trainees, we are seeing a decrease, as I mentioned, in the overall devices, but we're seeing the greatest decrease in injuries involving suture needles. So again, we don't know if that is related to reporting or proficiency. And we are seeing a slight decrease among injuries with the hypodermic needles and syringes. When we looked at the data by when the injury occurred over academic quarters, we were seeing the greatest decrease of injuries that are occurring during use. And again, that's the time when the presence or absence of the Sharps injury prevention feature, it doesn't matter as much. And so this may speak to some improved proficiency. Some of the strengths of our system, we do get reporting from all of the hospitals within Massachusetts. That is not to say that we get all of the injuries, because we do know there's significant underreporting. And our completeness and data quality, we have very few that are missing, or we can't classify the information. I mentioned the underreporting as a limitation and the inability to distinguish postgraduate years. We also would love to have a denominator on the number of procedures used, and while we can get information on the number of procedures that occur within the healthcare facility, we've tried to tease out which ones involve Sharps and which ones don't, and that's become a rather cumbersome task. So our key findings, majority of the injuries is sustained by medical trainees. Recapping still is a big issue. Clearly slow adoption of devices with Sharps injury prevention features, and the decrease in injuries among medical trainees throughout the academic quarters. How does this relate to prevention? Well, certainly we need to replace the devices lacking Sharps injury prevention features and get in more safe products. We need to focus on increased training among medical trainees. And because of, it was mentioned that the trainees are, they're rotating through four hospitals in the previous study, and so we find, or we're hearing, that there's very little training that happens every time they get to a new site relative to Sharps injury prevention. And that is our data. I want to actually acknowledge Vivian Poon, who did all of this work and couldn't be here today. And I want to acknowledge all the people who provide the data to us, without which I'd have nothing to show you. So thank you. Any questions? We don't collect any information on length of service, either over career or time at institution or time on shift.
So. Would that be possible?
No, our system isn't set up to collect that information. We'd have to do a separate study. Eileen? I do believe, and this is where I really wish Vivian were here, but I do believe that we have the ability to get FTEs for both physicians who are employees of the hospitals and then the interns and residents, and we're able to restrict our numerator to match those, but I don't have that today. Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay, well now we'll open it up to general questions. I know we had, for reasons of time, to cut off questions. So if you want to address your question to any of the panelists, they'll come up and answer it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not mixed completely then, because when it dries out, then the powder is available to be picked up by Well, actually, in this hospital and in many hospitals, the IV is completely mixed in the pharmacy, and when it comes to exposures to those pharmacy staff during the mixing is probably would be another good research effort. But in this hospital, the IVs are ready and they're primed and they're set up to not cause any splashes or spillages. However, talking with nurses, I guess if kind of like I said earlier, just throughout the day, spikes happen, punctures in IV bags happen, or the patient removes it, or the IV pole falls down, and that's possible sources around that area, and also. Like cyclophosphamide, a very common drug. They've been shown to it can exist in its form for several weeks dried, and several. There are products that hospitals can buy. Mats for chemotherapy spillage mats for neck under the IV pole or near the bed as well, so when the IV is done, taking it off the pole, disposing it in the chemotherapy bin. Is another I would say a possibility of a spillage there. So.
Well, according to the occupational hierarchy of controls, engineering controls are first, administrative, and then PPE is last. It's really the last line of defense. And so what I basically meant by that is that PPE use becomes even more important, especially when vaccination is unavailable, because that administrative control is not possible, PPE use becomes more important. That is not to say that when vaccination is available, PPE use shouldn't be encouraged.
I'm sorry, say the last part of your question. I think it would, in that I think there would be, more of a hammer being held over healthcare organizations to see that their institutions are compliant. So there would be an incentive to provide that training rather than just the, the cursory training that many healthcare workers get when they hire onto a new hospital or clinic. So yes, I think that there would be increased amounts of training to particularly, looking at safety with sharps and musculoskeletal disorders and that sort of thing.
And I think it also mandates the purchase of equipment.
It does, that's right. Yes, safe lifting equipment.
Can I just add to that, if it's the bill that I'm remembering, I could be wrong.
Yeah, here you are.
If it's the bill that I'm remembering, and I could be wrong, but it sort of mirrors the bloodborne pathogen standard and the requirements that you have to go through a variety of different control measures, as was mentioned, the hierarchy of controls, and that training is specifically included in that.
Right, that's H.R. 2381, the Nurse and Healthcare Worker Protection Act of 2009. Actually, I had a question for you.
Okay.
Anecdotally, what have you been hearing from the people you interview as far as why they're not using safe needles, and what are the excuses you get? And has there been any kind of a push from administration to, you know, make hospitals an unsafe needle-free zone like we did with latex, you know, years ago?
So all of our data comes in electronically, and I don't get to talk to the injured workers. It's actually an anonymous system. Is that better? Sorry. I've done a lot of talking lately, and I just been quiet lately. So I would say that, you know, the reason that people are not using the appropriate devices is not because healthcare workers are choosing to do the wrong thing and use the wrong devices. It's because the right devices are not being made available in sufficient quantities. And while I see somebody disagreeing, but with the exception perhaps surgeons, who getting them to convert is very, very challenging. But when you look at floor staff, nurses, phlebotomists, they want to use the right products. And I get out into almost all of the 100 hospitals, and they're not always available. And while we have had this law for 10 years, we don't get explicit pushback from the hospital saying we won't do this, but we get reasons like, well, the cost is too high. And I said, well, let me remind you, OSHA made very clear you can't use cost as a determining factor. They say, listen, these prepackaged kits to do central lines and PICC lines, we have to go, and this is true, they have to go through an inventory of all their kits, and then they have to look at the individual products that are in the kits, and then they have to negotiate with the kit packers to get the right products in place. And while a new syringe with a Sharps injury prevention feature might cost a dollar more than the old syringe, the upcharge on the kit can be as much as $20. And when you multiply that over the, you know, while I know cost can't be a factor, they're saying, hey, listen, not only is this a lot of work to figure out what we have to change, but this isn't fair. And so what they're asking me to do, and we're starting to do, is to advocate on their behalf to get the manufacturers to step up. I was just at a meeting last week in front of manufacturers where I called for them to stop selling the products in the clinical care setting that don't meet the requirements. There is no law that puts any responsibility on the manufacturers. The sole responsibility is on the employer, and I think that that's a big gap. We can't buy cars without seatbelts. We're all required to wear seatbelts. These workers have to use the right devices, and they have to be provided, but there's no responsibility on the part of manufacturers or kit packers to sell the right products. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, very good.
Okay, if there's no further questions, I'll thank you.